Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So welcome everyone here to Mark Nepo's talk for today. So it's my pleasure to introduce him actually. So Mark is a poet, author of the best-selling author, I should say, of the Book of Awakening and the Book of Souls, 52 Paths to Living What Matters, along with a lot of other stuff too. So he's been called one of the finest spiritual guides of our time, a consummate storyteller and an eloquent spiritual teacher. Today he's going to be talking to us about living at pace of what is real, listening to your authentic voice. So Mark will invite us using timeless and contemporary stories and poems to surface part of our own story, the chance to discover how we all connect in the one conversation of life. So it's a pleasure to have you here, Mark, and take us away.
Thank you. Thank you so much and welcome everyone. And thank you for being a part of this amazing conference and for joining me in this session. So as Steve said, I want to explore this theme of living at the pace of what is real and listening to our authentic voice. And under that is how the life of embodiment is always centered on our commitment to live what we know. So let me begin with a poem and a story. The poem is a short poem of mine called Inside Everything. Keep trying to hide, and in time, you become a wall. Keep trying to love, and in time, you become love. Our journey on earth is to stop hiding so we can become love. Everything else is a seduction and a distraction. Courage is staying true. So being human, of course, we fall out of living what we know, and our job often, more often than not, is how to return. I'll talk more about the practice of return as we move on. But now here's a story about embodiment. Now, some of you might know that in America, in Boulder, Colorado, there is a Buddhist-based university known as Naropa. And I've been blessed to teach there a few times, speak, you know, visiting. And I'm always interested in, you know, so I was like, the first time I was there, well, why Naropa? Why are you calling it this? And finally, I found someone, an older professor, who told me this amazing story. So in the 11th century in India, Naropa was a world scholar of known religious traditions. He was this remarkable man who had studied not just Buddhism and Hinduism, but everything around the world. And he was rather well regarded. And so one day, and I can't remember exactly what city he was living in, but one day he was walking down the street in the city and he crossed paths with an old woman who was walking with a cane. And as they got just about, you know, alongside each other, she stopped and she said, "Aren't you Naropa?" And he said, well, yes, I am. And it turned out that he was getting ready to, you know, give an autograph. He was all pumped up. And she went, And they walked past each other. They said their pleasantries. And about 10, 15 feet after they passed each other, she stopped and turned around and said, do you know the heart of all those traditions? And he was caught by surprise. He said, of course I do. And then they walked on a little further, and he knew in his heart he had lied. And so Naropa ran after the old woman and knelt down before her and said, be my teacher. So Naropa is a symbol of embodied wisdom. I love that story. And it makes so much sense that a university would be based on embodied wisdom. And it has always been true that when who we are and what we do are one, well, we know this moment as a moment of congruence and integrity. And our congruence and integrity has always involved removing what's between us and life. You know, windows get dirty and we have to clean them. Well, so too the window of the heart, the mind, the eyes, the ears. This is part of living, and part of our job of staying embodied and real and authentic is the return to cleaning the windows of our mind and heart and eyes. When we can remove what's between us and life, well, then briefly, we are blessed to live at the pace of what is real. Well, what do we mean by this? What do I mean by this? Well, for me, living at the pace of what is real is when I can align, when my mind, my heart, and my body move at the same pace, breathe at the same pace. When they align, something, there's some feeling of peace, of where it's when we have peak moments, you know, suddenly when, however briefly, when my mind and heart and body can slow down and move together, everything starts to glow. Everything starts to see through. It's almost as if the mind, the heart, and the body are mystical tumblers in a lock. And when they all align, oh, it opens and we get glimpse wholeness and eternity and the truth of the universe. You know, the heart connects the mind and the body, and we can't stay there. And then, you know, I trip on the stairs all of a sudden, and now my heart's racing, and now they're not moving in alignment. And so we're always course correcting, but I find when I can do that, when I can align my mind and my heart and my body, things slow down, things open up, I feel more connected and able to hear the truth and oneness of the universe. So by practicing this, we can return to what matters, but it's also true that great love and suffering return us to what matters. And story, I'll talk a little bit tonight about the importance of story. Story returns us to what matters. And all this takes a quiet, constant courage to live at the pace of what is real and to return to what matters. Because again, being human, no one can stay there. You know, I personally don't believe in an arrived state of enlightenment. Maybe that's possible for some remarkable spirits, but that's not been my experience in my time on earth. You know, my time on earth is I'm clear and then I'm confused. I feel safe and sound, and then I'm dizzy and I'm afraid. You know, medieval monks, when asked how they practiced their faith, said, by falling down and getting up. I love that. That seems more true to the struggle and beauty of being human. And it's interesting that courage, one of my early books is called Finding Inner Courage. And as I explored that, and each of my books is an inquiry, it's how I learn. And the words are the trail of that inquiry. But I learned that the original idiom for courage, you know, the word courage in Latin, it comes from the word cor, C-O-R, which means heart. But the first expression or idiom of courage. Courage meant to stand by one's core. And when we stand by our core, we line up with the core of life. And then we're stronger than just ourselves. And we're more clear than just ourselves. So it's interesting, as we look at all this, I want to offer that there are three enduring qualities, at least, but let's just focus tonight on three spiritual elements, if you will, that are always available, and they allow us to stand by our core and return to the pace of what is real. And they are presence, meaning, and relationship. And these are as vital as air, water, and fire. So I want to share a story about each, about presence, meaning, and relationship. And as I do, I ask you, as you listen, to think about how you might personalize where each of these spiritual elements lives in your life. What is your relationship to presence, to meaning, and to relationship itself? So the first, as we look at presence, there's an interesting thing about presence. And presence is the way that we restore our direct experience of life with nothing in the way. So I want to start here with this part about Buddha. And in the life of Buddha, you know, so many amazing stories. But one is that a student asked him one day, how rare is it to be born in human form? Because presence returns us to how rare it is to be here at all. And once we are how rare it is to be here at all, once we recover that, we see with different eyes, we hear with different ears, we feel with a different heart. So his student said, well, how rare is it to be born in human form? And Buddha said, imagine a giant sea turtle asleep at the bottom of the sea. And imagine that it wakes and it drifts, it makes its way up to the top of the surface, it breaks surface, it looks around. And now imagine that sea turtle goes back down to the bottom and falls asleep a second time. And Buddha said, the odds of that sea turtle waking and breaking surface in the same exact spot twice, that's how rare it is to be born in human form. Wow. Amazing. So I want to read a piece about this, about our precious human birth, which is from the Book of Awakening, January 1st in that spiritual day book of mine, that talks about how rare it is to be here at all and the gift of presence. It's a few paragraphs. There is a Buddhist precept that asks us to be mindful of how rare it is to find ourselves in human form on earth. It's really a beautiful view of life that offers us the chance to feel enormous appreciation for the fact that we are here at all, as individual spirits filled with consciousness, drinking water, chopping wood, doing the dishes, paying the bills. It asks us to look about at the ant and the antelope, at the worm and the butterfly, at the dog and the bull, at the hawk and the wild lonely tiger, at the 100-year-old oak and 1,000-year-old patch of ocean. It asks us to understand that no other life form has the consciousness of being that we are privileged to. It asks us to recognize that of all the endless species of plants and animals and minerals that make up the earth, and they have their own consciousness for sure, but a very small portion of life has the wakefulness of spirit that we call being human. That I can rise from some depth of awareness to express this to you now, and that you right now can receive this in this instant, well, this is part of our precious human birth. You could have been an ant. I could have been an ant eater. You could have been rain. I could have been a lick of salt, but we were blessed in this time, in this place, to be human beings, alive in rare ways we often take for granted. All of this to say, this precious human birth is unrepeatable. So what will you do today, knowing that you are one of the rarest forms of life to ever walk the earth? How will you carry yourself? What will you do with your hands? What will you ask and of whom? Tomorrow you could die and become an ant and someone will be setting traps for you. But today you are precious and rare and awake. It ushers us into grateful living. It makes hesitation useless. Grateful and awake, ask what you need to know now. Say what you feel now. Love what you love now. And so presence returns us to this precious human birth, how rare it is to be here. And presence, as one of the spiritual elements, it's always there. You know, it's like a radio station. The radio station is always sending the signal, but my radio might not always pick it up. So as an individual human being, I might lose track of my presence. But when I can return and hold nothing back and be fully present, then I will return to living at the pace of what is real. And I will remember how rare it is to be here at all. So this brings us, you know, there's this central paradox about life. No one can live your life for you. No one can feel what you feel, see what you see, experience or have the wisdom that you have for being here. And the other side of the paradox is no one can make it alone. I believe that life has been made just difficult enough that we need each other to ensure the journey of love. And it seems that part of the spiritual physics, if you will, of life is that everyone will have a chance to be dropped into the depth of life. And it doesn't matter how that happens. It might be by being loved or being broken open, or it might be through surprise or beauty or confusion or doubt. But however it happens, it can be anything. This is when the deeper journey truly begins, as is happening now for all of us in this worldwide pandemic. We are all being forced to stop. We're all being forced to open up, to be more vulnerable, to take off our inner masks, paradoxically, while we need outer masks to be safe. And what matters is how we face this depth once it's opened, and how to keep each other company once we're there. So presence is how we restore our direct connection to life and my direct experience of life. Certainly we can learn from others, but in order to be embodied, we have to have our own experience. But this is now how we move to meaning. Because if I'm only left with my own experience, oh boy, because life is so much more than any one person's experience. So by being present, I also become open to your presence and your experience. So meaning is how we connect with others. Meaning is how we grow beyond just our experience. I need that presence to come alive, but if I just stay there, I will become stubborn and biased and trapped in my own convictions. So let me share a small story about meaning. And this comes from my book, The One Life We're Given, a few paragraphs here. A troubled widower made his way to ask a wise old woman about his troubles. The old woman received him and they walked along a stream. She could see the pain in his face. He began to tremble as he asked, "What's the point? Is there any meaning to life?" She invited him to sit on a large stone near the stream. She took a long branch and swirled it in the water, and then replied, "Well, it all depends on what it means to you to be alive." In his sorrow, the man dropped his shoulders, and the old woman gave him the branch and said, "Go on, touch the branch to the water." As he poked the branch in the running stream, there was something confirming and comforting about feeling the movement of the water in his hand through the branch. Well, the old woman touched his hand and said, "You see that you can feel the water without putting your hand in the water. This is what meaning feels like." The man grew tender, but still seemed puzzled. The old woman drew closer and said, very gently, "Close your eyes and feel your wife now gone, that you can feel her in your heart without being able to touch her. This is how meaning saves us." The widower began to cry. The old woman put her arm around him and said, "No one knows how to live or how to die. We only know how to love and how to lose and how to pick up branches of meaning along the way." So that's part of what we're doing in our life of embodiment, which we can't always maintain. We need presence to realize and remember how rare it is to be here, to inhabit our precious human birth. And then we need to pick up branches of meaning along the way. Just like that widower touching the water through the branch without actually putting his hand in the water, we touch into the truth of each other's lives, picking up branches of meaning. Now, it's always been remarkable. You know, I'm 69, and in my 30s, some of you know from my books that I'm a long-term cancer survivor. In my 30s, I almost died from a rare form of lymphoma. And it's just always been amazing to me how messy and magnificent being human is. We are constantly both fragile and resilient. This too is part of the embodied life. This is part of living at the pace of what is real. And being human is both very universal, that is, our deepest experiences are those we have in common, and at the same time, very personal. So we do have, as I mentioned, this practice of return. We always are falling off and coming back. You know, my father, who's now gone, but he was a master woodworker, and he loved the sea, and he had built a 30-foot sailboat that I spent a lot of my youth on. And when I was a little boy, he must have sensed that I could give full attention to things and be very focused. And when we'd be in a fog, there was a directional compass, and he would put me on the tiller or the steering device for the sailboat. And I would be charged, go in this direction, stay on course as best you can. So even as a little boy, and anyone who's ever tried to steer by a compass knows that even when you're on course, that compass never stands still. It's always going like this. It's always moving, a little to the left, a little to the right. So you are always course, even when you're on course, you're always course correcting. You're always going, oh, I'm drifting to the right. I got to go this way. Oh, I got to go that way. So too the practice, the spiritual practice of being a soul in a body in time on earth. We are always course correcting. And so this brings us, you know, we talked about presence and meaning. This brings us to relationship, because what holds everything together within us and between us is the life of relationship, which is never done. It always involves course correction. So here's a story about relationship. You know, I live in Michigan in the United States. And in this part of the country, the Native American tribe that were our ancestors here were known as the Ojibwe Nation. The Ojibwe Nation. And most indigenous traditions, their creation stories are a constellation of smaller stories of how different parts of life came into being. And so in the Ojibwe tradition, this story is called The Work of the Worm. So it seems that the Great Spirit, having created all the different objects and beings in the world, was looking how to connect everything in life. When a little worm inched over and popped its head up and said, "Oh, Great Spirit, I can help," Well, the little great spirit was taken aback that one of its smallest creatures was offering help. And the great spirit looked down at the worm and said, "Very well, little worm, help us." So the little worm inched away to the nearest branch and began to spin barely seeable silk threads and through its guts, and then began to weave them through all the things and living creatures of the universe. And you know how many of you have seen, I'm sure, at some point in your life, a giant spider web. And unless the light is on it, you can't really see it. It's barely seeable. But when the light hits it, oh my God, it's this golden latticework, this golden web that's so beautiful. Well, when the little worm was done weaving its barely seeable threads among everything in the world, the great spirit leaned over like the sun, and the light of the great spirit for a moment made all of those silk threads visible. And the great spirit said, "Thank you, little worm, you have saved us, not by being great or brilliant, but by being true to your own nature." And then the great spirit said, "I will let you live forever." Well, the little worm was taken aback, and the great spirit could see this and leaned over and said, "Don't you want to live forever?" And the little worm looked up at the great spirit and said, "Oh, Father, I fear so many years if I can't grow." Such wisdom from such a little creature. And the great spirit said, "You are wise, little worm. Very well, little worm. I will give you this ability to spin these barely seeable threads from your guts around yourself. And then when you can be still enough, long enough, and stop squirming and spinning and inching around, in time, you will know the lightness of being that I know. Go." And so the little worm inched to the nearest branch, to the nearest leaf, and began to spin the very first cocoon, and in time became the first butterfly. I love that story. I love these ancient anonymous teaching stories. You know, long before there were degree programs and universities, education and wisdom were passed on through stories, mostly anonymous stories. And what touches me about this story, why I tell it, why it involves living at the pace of what is real and embodiment, is that the little worm spins the threads that connect everything in the universe, not from its mind, not even from its heart, but from its guts. What does this say? Well, to me, it says, we cannot bypass embodiment. We cannot bypass inner processing. We cannot bypass internalizing and digesting our experience. And when we do authentic inner work, we are also spinning the threads that hold life together. It is one and the same work. Wow. Nobody talked about that when I was growing up in school. So through relationship, when you do honest inner work, you are also spinning, naming, and repairing the connections, the threads that hold life together. Because we are more together than alone. A way to understand this is a metaphor which comes from the body, also from embodiment. And this is the metaphor of circulation. The blood circulates in our bodies through all the organs, from one organ to the next. No one organ owns the blood. If it did, or if it gets stuck there, the body dies. Each organ borrows the blood, processes it, that is, it embodies the very blood that moves through it and passes it on to the next. Well, no one soul owns the circulation of love and authenticity and aliveness. If we try to own it, our connections die. The connections and the threads tear apart. We must pass the love on. And this is very important today. So let me move and talk a little bit about the importance of story as one of the practices, you know, and this is a little different. I know we're used to, especially when we talk about embodiment, about breath work and body work and yoga. Well, story is a yoga of the heart. Story, the practice of story is a way to stay embodied and connected. Stories keep us real. Stories keep us in our body and in the connection of all life. Stories stitch us together. They carry the seeds of humanity. They teach us. They heal us. Stories are our teacher. And one of the amazing paradoxes about story is that at heart, our stories are the same. Your story and my story are very personal, but when we get to the very center, they're the same story. Each of our stories is a sentence in the one story of life. In fact, each of our stories is one of those barely seeable threads that the worm was weaving that connects everything. So let me share this poem of mine called Below Our Strangeness. My soul tells me we were all broken from the same nameless heart, and everything wakes with a piece of that original heart aching its way into blossom. This is why we know each other below our strangeness. Why, when we fall, we lift each other, or when in pain, we hold each other. Why, sudden, with joy, we dance together. Life is the many pieces of that great heart loving itself back together. Life is the many pieces of that great heart loving itself back together. We are all born with a piece of that one nameless heart, and we are all loving that nameless heart back together, and stories show us how to do this. The great poet Muriel Rukeyser, now she was an American poet, died about 15 years ago, but in one of her poems, she has this wonderful three lines. It goes, say it, the universe is made of stories. Not atoms, that the building blocks of the universe are stories. And we must understand that stories are like music. You know, in music, unless you're a very talented musician, sheet music, you know, a talented musician might read sheet music and hear the music in their mind. But for most of us, even if we can read sheet music at all, that's not the same as playing it. And it's the same with stories. Certainly stories can be read on a page, but they need to be told the way sheet music needs to be played. This is the key to living at the pace of what is real. This is the key to embodiment. Our stories have to be played, inhabited. They have to come alive. And so here's a quote from Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher who authored I, Thou, the great classic book of the 20th century. And Martin Buber talked, this is a story about stories, very short. Martin Buber says, quote, a story must be told in such a way that it constitutes help in itself. Take my grandfather who was lame. Once they asked him to tell a story about his teacher, and he related how his teacher used to hop and dance while he prayed. He was so in love with life. And in the telling, my grandfather rose as he spoke. He got so excited, and he was so swept away by his own story that he began to hop and dance to show how his master had done. And from that hour, he was cured of his lameness. That's how to tell a story. end quote. Something else happens when we're present and we realize our precious birth. Something else happens when we reach for the stick of meaning between us. Something else happens when a good, true story is told out loud. It returns us to living at the pace of what is real. And again, we go back to indigenous tradition. So in the Native American cultures, this was very well known. So Native American medicine men and women, when someone ill was brought to them, they would listen, they would examine them, they would look at them, and then they would ask four diagnostic questions. They would say, you don't feel well. When was the last time you danced? You have a headache. When was the last time you sang? Your heart is heavy. When was the last time you told your story? And when was the last time you listened to the stories of others? And then that medicine, that man or woman, that shaman would say, go, inhabit these four questions and come back in a month and we'll see how you're doing. And I offer that these are great questions still. I ask you and invite you to ask yourself these questions. When was the last time you danced? When was the last time you sang? When was the last time you told your story or listened to the stories of others? So here's a more contemporary story of embodiment, and it happened in the state of Massachusetts, rural Massachusetts, in the 1940s, late 30s, early 40s. And there was a divinity student, 19, 20 years old, and he was, you know, studying very hard and was going to go into the priesthood. And he was studying, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he was stricken with polio. What an awful thing. And of all the responses he could have to finding himself with polio, he decided that he would quit divinity school and learn how to dance. Well, all of his friends and his colleagues and his teachers admired him, but privately said, oh, poor guy, oh, God. And very slowly and awkwardly, he not only learned how to dance, he cured himself of his polio and went on to become one of the fathers of modern American dance. This is the story of Ted Shawn, who started Jacob's Pillow, which is still an active dance studio and theater in Western Massachusetts. He was a teacher of some of the great modern dancers, such as Alvin Alley and Martha Graham and Paul Taylor. And we all know that he might not have cured his polio. He might not have even become a dancer. But the heart of this story, the teaching, the inspiration, is that studying God had no chance of healing him. Dancing God did. Embodying God did, whatever that might mean to you. And it awkwardly and steadily, he embodied the dance of God. And this is there's another deep lesson in this story that occurs when we can live at the pace of what is real, no matter how briefly. And that is, he was called into loving what's in the way until it ceases to be an obstacle. This is very beautiful and very hard, and also very obvious. We are called to love what's in the way until it ceases to be an obstacle. So I want to bring in three more voices and expressions from these voices that also point to things that help us return to living at the pace of what is real and start to speak to how we listen to our authentic voice. So the first is an old Zen story. It's only two sentences long, an old anonymous Zen story, which goes like this. "Why is the road to freedom so long?" asked a troubled apprentice. And the master replied, "Because it has to go through you." "Why is the road to freedom so long?" asked a troubled apprentice. And the master replied, "Because it has to go through you." And the key word is through. And, you know, at first we might hear this as a criticism of the master to the student, but I don't hear it that way. I hear it as a geographical answer, that it takes a long time to find inner freedom because it naturally has to go through us. And this is the life of experience, where we learn an inch of wisdom and experience at a time. So the road to freedom is long and winding because it has to go through us. There's no bypassing that. The second voice which speaks to us is an old Sioux saying, and this is also Native American, an old anonymous Sioux saying that says, "The longest journey you will make in your life is from your head to your heart." The longest journey you will make in your life is from your head to your heart. And when we make this journey, letting life move through us, when we allow life to settle from our head into our heart, which happened to me by almost dying from cancer, we start to become in touch with our authentic voice, which connects our soul with the soul of the universe. And this third voice is that of Dag Hammarskjöld. And maybe some of you remember Dag Hammarskjöld. He was the second Secretary General of the United Nations, who died in a plane crash in 1961. And in his journals, which were found after his death, there's this wonderful saying. He said, "I don't know who or what put the question. I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering, but at some moment I did answer yes to someone or something. And from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful and that my life in self-surrender has a goal." So by being present, by being embodied, by living at the pace of what is real, Dag Hammarskjöld discovered how to say yes to life. So how do we find the road to inner freedom? How do we journey from our head to our heart? How do we say yes to life? These are questions we need to ask repeatedly. And by listening to our authentic voice, the voice within, this is our guide to staying real. So what do I mean by our voice? Well, I would offer to you, it is the tuning fork of the sacred. It is that part of us that when it is rung by what we know to be real and true, it echoes in concert with all of existence. It is the foundational sense of life that we carry below all we've taught and below all that happens to us. Our voice opens us to the voice of life. How do we find our voice, listen to our voice? By following our heart. You know, the word trust literally means follow your heart. That means when you're touched by something, when you see a glimpse of light in an alley and it catches you and it says, it means follow that. Put down your plans and spend an extra few minutes looking at the light in the alley. Let the light of your life and the light of life inform each other. And we do this by staying authentic, by staying embodied. You know, the word authentic literally means, comes from the Greek, authentis. It means the mark of the hands. The mark of the hands, what we feel in here, and this brings us all the way back to living what we know. What starts in our heart has to live in the world through our hands, through our hands. So, you know, I want to quickly tell a story of embodiment from my father. You know, I mentioned he was gone, but when I was a boy, and he would also build these very amazing model boats out of wood. He would get blueprints from sailing ships from the 1800s and then build them to scale. He'd make little rails and little rudders and masts and everything. And one time I was 8 or 9 and I was sitting on the steps of the basement watching him work with a tweezer very carefully for a long, long time. He didn't know I was watching him. And I didn't realize till years later, he was teaching me the secret life of detail. He was showing me that immersion was more important than excellence. Because when he was immersed, yes, his immersion led to excellence, but when he was building, when he gave his all to build that little ship, he was in the gesture of everyone who ever built a ship in history. And the reward for immersion is the experience of oneness. And when we, this is why when we, this that small part of the heart that brings us to the great part, when I can love you in particular wholeheartedly, I am in the moment of everyone who ever loved. This is why in compassion, when I feel your pain, if I am doing it thoroughly, I am in the moment of all pain, and I am feeling everyone who ever held someone in pain. So we are blessed that we can strengthen our authentic voice by listening for the stories that are our teachers, by listening for what heartens us more than what disheartens us, for returning how to live at the pace of what is real, and for trying to cultivate our personal practices of presence, meaning, and relationship. Presence, meaning, and relationship. So I want to invite you to offer you two questions to take with you that you can journal with at another time. One is, in your journal, can you tell the story of a time you were fully immersed in creating, repairing, or caring for something or someone? What led you to be so present? What did this complete immersion feel like? And how has this experience affected you? And the second question I would invite you to do at another time is to tell your own foundational story. I told the story of my father with building the model, the little boats, and what that brought to me. Can you tell one story that feels foundational to your life? It could be a positive story or it could be a negative story. But can you tell this story as you would a myth? And can you discuss in your own writing the lesson this myth carries for you and how it's changed your understanding of life? What truth does your foundational story return you to? So I want to leave you with a poem of mine and thank you for your presence and your attention. And I'm so grateful to be a part again of this wonderful conference. I want to leave you with a poem of mine called Breaking Surface. And it goes like this. Let no one keep you from your story. You're no rabbi or priest, no mother who wants you to dig for treasures she misplaced, no father who won't let one life be enough, no lover who measures their worth by what you might give up, no voice that tells you in the night it can't be done. Let nothing dissuade you from seeing what you see or feeling the winds that make you want to dance alone or go where no one has yet to go. You are the only explorer, your heart, the unreadable compass, your soul, the shore of a promise too great to be ignored. So I wish you all many blessings and stay well and be safe. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mark, for the wonderfully meaningful session. I think there's a few things coming through. People even saw one that brought someone to tears. I think nice ones, I hope. Or maybe. And where can people find out a little bit more about you? There's marknepo.com. Is there any other places you'd like to direct people?
Yeah, so I am offering online retreats and webinars, and people can find out about them through live.marknepo.com. And in fact, I'm just finishing one Sunday, but Sunday, a new webinar that'll be coming up will go live for registration starting Sunday. And my books are, you can find them anywhere, yeah.
And it's like over 20 of them or something, right?
Yeah.
Right is life. So thank you again for that presentation. And in terms of anyone tuning in or you want to tell your friends, this will be available for 48 hours after this session. And then you can also get it as part of the package. So in terms of that, if you would like to own the entire library of the conference to digest in your own time, we do appreciate as a thank you to us for putting this event on, enables everyone else to access it for free if you were to purchase the package. So it came with quite a bit of work. So you can do that and upgrade to the package there. And also after this session, if you'd like to digest some of this stuff that Mark has said, you can head across to the coffee break rooms, which are sort of like small breakout rooms on Zoom, where you can just chat to some other people who are in sessions, which might be a nice way to sort of integrate any sort of learnings. And also do the same on a Facebook group and join any discussions over there and sort of check out any stuff that presenters will post there. And that's a lot. That's about it, I think. Mark, I would like to invite you, if you would like to share one final sort of top tip on how to be more embodied.
Well, I think that for me these days, ironically, especially because we're all, so many of us are sheltering, we're socially distanced, and yet it's a practice of being embodied through compassion. And so let me offer this one stanza of mine from another poem, and it goes like this. The mystery is that whoever shows up when we dare to give has exactly what we need hidden in their trouble.
Thank you, Mark. And with that, I'll close the room. I've just posted marknepo.com once more there. And I see Minal's made an appearance as well, just to say thank you. So thank you, everyone.